al-Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a US drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as US President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
In the limelight.
Canadians are joining the criminal army of the Israeli regime and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable, says Nora Barris-Friedman Ryder in an article titled, Israeli Regime Illegally Recruits Canadian Citizens to Its Army. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Human rights activists are demanding an end to the Israeli regime military recruitment of Canadians, which violates the laws of that country. The Canadian government has so far refused to enforce its laws, allowing the Zionist regime to continue the practice. Canadians joined Zionist militias during the Nakba, the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in 1947 and 1948. The Zionist regime army has boasted in recent years that it has enlisted hundreds of Canadian citizens to its occupation military, joining other foreigners, including those from the U.S. The CBC reported last year that Canadian government agencies do not keep track of how many of its citizens join the Israeli regime army. Last year, the Zionist regime's consulate in Toronto said that a representative of its military would be interviewing potential recruits. Legal experts say this is a violation of the Foreign Enlistment Act, which prohibits a foreign state from enlisting Canadian citizens into its armed forces. The act, which passed in 1937, was originally an anti-communist measure to criminalize Canadians who traveled to Spain to help fight against the fascist Franco dictatorship. In mid-October, 170 prominent Canadian faith leaders, activists, artists, and intellectuals called on Justice Minister David Lametti to investigate and potentially take legal action against all those involved in the recruiting and encouraging recruiting in the country for the Israeli regime army. In addition to the prominent Canadian signatories, scholar Noam Chomsky, Pink Floyd Roger Waters, filmmaker Ken Loach, Nobel Peace Laureate Merritt McGuire and journalist Chris Hedges signed the letter. John Pilpat, a criminal litigation attorney and international law expert, filed a formal complaint with Lametti over the Zionist regime's recruitment within Canada. Such recruitment is a crime under the Criminal Code of Canada, Pilpat told the electronic Antifaza. Philpott also called on Lametti to investigate Deborah Lyons, Canada's ambassador to the occupied Palestine, who held a party at the country's embassy in Tel Aviv to honor its citizens serving in the Israeli regime army. Only 33 of the 78 Canadian citizens in the Israeli regime army were able to attend the January event. Many were unavailable because they were deployed to the Golan Heights, Syrian territory occupied by the Zionist regime, and along the Gaza boundary, Canada's defense attach told media. "We consider that Lyons potentially is encouraging people to join the Israeli regime army and could be charged," Philpott said. Nearly 1,500 people have sent letters to the Lametti demanding that recruiting schemes be stopped. Lametti deferred responsibility to the police. "It is necessary that the diplomats from another country, therefore the diplomats of Israel who are here, follow Canadian law," he said. "It is up to the police investigators to decide whether there have been offenses and, if there is one, for the prosecutor to proceed with formal charges." Following Justice Minister Lametti's response, Philpott sent a complaint to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in early November. The RCMP acknowledged receipt of the complaint, according to Philpott. Canada's pro-Israeli regime policies, including its opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, are out of step with public opinion. A September poll found that 86% of Canadians do not want the Israeli regime to be held to a different standard than other countries. "The fact that illegal recruiting by Israeli regime can happen here with impunity is a reflection of the overall situation," Bruce Katz, co-president of the group Palestinian and Jewish Unity, told the electronic Intifada. "We are dealing with a very well-organized, well-funded machine," Katz added, referring to the Israeli regime lobby groups that have a distorting influence over Canadian policy. "They can be held liable." Philpott said that leaders of schools who promote a student enlistment into the Israeli regime army could be liable to charges. "Various lone soldier programs attract and sponsor international recruits to the Zionist regime military." As reporter Yves Engler has noted, some Jewish schools in Toronto, for example, incorporate promotion of the Zionist regime troops and army officials into their curricula. The Zionist regime lobby groups also promote the regime's military propaganda at Canadian universities. In November 2019, Palestine rights activists were physically attacked by far-right extremists at York City in Toronto when they protested an event glorifying Israeli regime troops. The event, featuring reservists on duty, a group created to defend the Zionist regime army and counter the Israeli regime boycott movement at university campuses, was hosted by Herut, a Canadian Zionist organization. The organizers billed the event as an opportunity to hear from real Zionist regime troops. Philpott said that human rights advocates should continue to document and protest these recruitment schemes. "Canadians are joining a criminal army and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable," Philpott warned.
Midstream.
Lebanon seems to have officially entered a black hole, as if its fall has become fate. Those who are pushing for a faster collapse are none other than those who stipulate removing Hezbollah from the entire political scene, or else behold the great collapse. The U.S.-led war against the Lebanese resistance with deadlier tools than those utilized in Afghanistan 2001, Iraq 2003, and Lebanon 2006 continues according to one main theory. Let the country collapse until we rebuild it without Hezbollah. A theory which Riyadh's Mohammed bin Salman completely supports despite the decline of his current position in the region's politics. However, he is always ready to interact whenever the opportunity arises, being the main financial guarantor for crafting disorder in the region. Until then, work will be resumed to complete the scattering of chaos in Lebanon through activating the dubious activities of NGOs, imposing new sanctions on Lebanese political figures, and pushing for instability in the country's national security, which makes the internal arena open to any possibility. What makes the current situation worrisome is that Israel today is present in every Arab country except the very few like Lebanon, meaning that the latter will not be allowed to deviate from this path and might be even forced to join the bandwagon of normalization. There is no longer any ambiguity that the corruption of the ruling elite and the absence of any serious effort to find a solution to the imminent collapse are helping the foreign powers push Lebanon towards this end goal. Economic observers view the country headed towards painful times in light of the downfall scenario that threatens all institutions which are no longer able to contain their dangerous repercussions. In parallel, Washington is activating its policy to destroy Lebanon in cooperation with local actors entrusted with the task, in addition to a set of basic pillars for its project run by the U.S. administration from abroad and the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The fruits of this chaotic labor have begun to appear at the level of both top health positions in public institutions and entry-level ones in everyday-born multi-million dollar NGOs in the country. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In light of the Arab-Israeli normalization, pressure is increasing on Lebanon to join the bandwagon. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is currently playing the role of a spectator, while the United States is working on its plan to implement a theory shared by Washington and Riyadh. Let the country collapse so that we rebuild it without Hezbollah. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mataz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Mataz, now it seems that work is resumed to maybe complete the sowing of chaos across Lebanon through activating NGOs, which usually they have Western-backed agendas and they are funded by also foreign powers by imposing maybe new sanctions on new political figures in Lebanon. And there is also this sense of loss of security in the country, which makes the internal scene just open to any sort of bad possibilities here. What is the worst case scenario for this country, in your opinion?
Well, absolutely. The worst case scenario at the moment would be absolute chaos. And this is something that the United States and Saudi Arabia have been extremely striving towards after all else has failed. We saw with the end of 2019 a movement on the streets, what was called the Cedar Revolution. We saw all these NGOs coming in, American NGOs, British NGOs, French NGOs, and what the common denominator between all of these NGOs was chaos. We saw no agenda, we saw no political structure, we saw no formation, we saw no organization. It was very evident that these NGOs and those that are behind them were striving to cause chaos on the streets and instability in order to pressure Lebanon and the powers that be in Lebanon to eliminate Hezbollah from the political equation here. And we saw a lull right after the U.S. elections. I think that's due to the U.S.'s allies here in Lebanon not being too certain on how things were going to go after Trump left the White House. But now it seems that Trump is trying to make up for lost time. We've got until January, the 20th of January, before he needs to leave the White House. And I think he's trying to invest everything he can, cause as much chaos in Lebanon and in the region, not just in Lebanon, but in Lebanon specifically, before he leaves office, so that he can make things extremely difficult for the next administration to come in and try and form any sort of political solution in the country.
Well, Mr. Mataz, a year ago, the main target of the, if you will, the protests or the revolution, whatever they want to put a name on it, was to expose the corrupt political class in Lebanon, and everyone is actually on board this. But now it is time maybe to drop them all. This is what the United States of America wants, regardless of the non-existence of any alternative option here. So the difference but between then, between October 2019 and now December 2020, is that there were no Abraham Accords, meaning there were no Israel and Bahrain, no Israel and UAE, no Israel and Sudan and Morocco. And now it seems that they are pushing, and I'm saying that the United States of America, Israel, and other allies of Israel in the region, pushing Lebanon to normalize ties with Israel and maybe force them to normalize in order for the country not to go into deep black hole here. Do you think that's actually possible given the situation?
Well, I think the United States needs to understand that that's not its call. Yeah, one would need to be a fool to assume that the United States cares about corruption in Lebanon and is after combating corruption in Lebanon and getting rid of the corrupt figures that we have here. Most, if not all, of those who are involved in the corruption in Lebanon are the United States, its allies. It is very evident that the U.S., and this isn't just new, this is for the last 50 years, 40 years at the very least, the United States' main objective in Lebanon and the region is to have all Arab nations normalize ties with the Zionist entity. There is no other agenda here. In order for them to continue, in order for the United States to continue along with its mission in the Middle East, in order for it to secure its assets and to secure its needs here in the Middle East, it needs to have everybody on board. And the greatest thorn in the side of the United States at the moment is the axis of resistance. And especially if we're talking about Arab nations, if we're talking about Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq today, leaving the Islamic Republic aside, these three nations right now are the only Arab nations, apart from, let's say, Algeria and whatnot, are the only Arab nations on the forefront that have not and will not normalize ties with the Zionist regime. The United States tried a few months ago by pushing for indirect negotiations regarding our maritime borders here in Lebanon.
We all knew that's not going to go to the end.
And it did not. And it's very evident that now the United States and Trump is trying to create an atmosphere in the region where Lebanon feels isolated. He wants to say, look, all your neighbors have normalized. But the question here is that these neighbors of ours in the Middle East, they normalized 40, 50 years ago.
They wouldn't, it's me saying this. Yeah. I'm just, this is Marwa saying this. They wouldn't even exist as Arab states had they not been normalizing from day one. They wouldn't even have what they call, it's a fake independence, if you will. The British Army would not even have left had they not accepted to be normalizing with Israel since the early 70s, late 60s. But the U.S. might be maybe trying to strike the basic security in Lebanon right now. This is what is worrisome for the Lebanese public, especially by emerging sleeper cells and maybe fabricating sedition between the different political parties in Lebanon. This is no longer a secret, by the way, as many political and security forces are talking openly about bad security situation and the existence of serious threats against Lebanon. That puts a lot of question marks on the August 4th explosion of Beirut. It was the most powerful non-nuclear explosion on the planet. What do you think the country will face in the event of something, God forbid, similar happens again?
Okay, if I may, just touching on your last point very quickly and then continue on to the next one. Just, we need to remember that when it comes to normalization in Lebanon, the United States and allies tried in the 1980s. We had a president
had an agreement.
Willing, we had an agreement, and we had a president who was willing to normalize the nature of the Lebanese people, cause the Lebanese people themselves to forcefully remove their president. Mm-hmm. Naturally, the Lebanese people reject normalization. Mm-hmm. As for the issue of chaos and the security, the current security situation in Lebanon, yes, for the past month or so, there has been excessive talk in the security circles about sleeper cells, about those willing to sow discord. We've even seen this slip on the lips of certain political figures in Lebanon. A few months ago, if you recall, it was no secret that Samir Jaja himself was speaking of 14,000 or 30,000 or 50,000 militiamen that he has willing to take to the streets. This is a scenario that is very serious, that the security apparatus is studying very well. But I think, and again, and this is a habit of the United States, they don't assess the situation very well in the Middle East. In Lebanon, assuming that we were to have absolute chaos, there is only one organization that would come up winning in this chaos.
And that's the only organization that's actually refusing to even get involved.
Absolutely.
Because they don't want any blood. I have less than 1 minute, but I need to ask this. The U.S. keeps saying we need to make Lebanon collapse and then rebuild it without Hezbollah. We're talking about more than 1.5 million Lebanese who give allegiance, not only support, to Hezbollah. What are they planning on doing with all of us?
They'd have to ship us all off to some desert somewhere, wouldn't they? I mean, it's absolutely irrational. Even President Macron of France, when he came right after the Beirut explosion, he came over here and he recognized and he said to the political parties, there is no Lebanon without Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the people here. Hezbollah is your farmers. It is your businessmen. It is the masses. Hezbollah is not a political movement made up of certain families. No, Hezbollah is the masses. It spreads all over Lebanon. And like you said, over 1.5 million, so more than half of the Lebanese population, is Hezbollah. You can't make Lebanon, you can't build a future Lebanon without Hezbollah and without the people of Hezbollah. This is absolutely irrational thinking.
And mind you, I'm saying 1.5, that's only the actual Shias who are
right.
giving allegiance to Hezbollah. I'm not even talking about the allies, the Christian, the Druze, the Sunnis, the allies of the resistance. I want to thank you very much. This was very interesting to talk to you, Mataz Al-Wahwah, political commentator with us from Beirut, to discuss the upcoming scenarios in Beirut. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, former Yemeni President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi announced last week the formation of a new power-sharing government in accordance with the terms of the so-called Riyadh Agreement, jointly signed with the Southern Transitional Council in November of last year. While the Saudi Foreign Ministry welcomed the formation of a government, falsely claiming that it includes all components of the Yemeni spectrum, the main excluded Yemeni political party, Ansarullah, declared that the government is a failed attempt at gathering those dispersed outside Yemen. Hadi's new government in this following report.
After a hard labor that lasted for more than a year, former Yemeni President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, who is hiding in Saudi Arabia, announced the birth of a new government that brings his supporters together with the members of the Transitional Council in accordance with the Riyadh Agreement. Hadi's announcement was met with restraint inside Yemeni circles, while Ansarullah considered this move merely an attempt to gather those dispersed outside Yemen and that it would soon prove its failure. The Riyadh Agreement, from which the new government seeks to take its legitimacy, has failed so far to establish a framework for understanding between the mercenaries of the aggression against Yemen in its two parts, the Saudi and Emirati. Until this day, it has been nothing but a tool to legitimize the colonial presence of the member of the coalition aggression in the southern and eastern governorates of Yemen. The Riyadh Agreement is the same illegitimate pact that the aggression countries used as a pretext for military intervention in the city of Aden, where Riyadh transferred thousands of Saudi soldiers there and established militias loyal to it in the governorates of Aden and Abyan and worked to control the governorate of Mahra. In the meantime, Hadi's illicit government faces many challenges, most notably the collapse of the national currency and the existing conflict between the countries of aggression, which was clearly reflected in the condition of their mercenaries on the ground and the conflict of sharing quotas between the parties of Hadi's government. And last but not least, the main challenge for Hadi is the achievements that the Yemeni army and the popular committees continue to attain, especially in the northern governorates, where they managed to liberate most of the land, and now they are close to controlling Ma'rib city, the last stronghold of the Hadi government in the north. Meanwhile, in a new achievement, the Yemeni Ministry of Interior announced last week the entry of armored vehicle Ba'as-1 to military service, noting that it is a 100% local production. The ministry confirmed that it was designed with high quality to work in various security operations.
Now with us to discuss this issue from Copenhagen is Mr. Roon Ayahuz. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Roon. You are a member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Now, it is not even a matter of discussion, at least for me, the last move by Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi had nothing to do with him, but rather it's just another political stunt by Saudi Arabia, maybe to savior or attempt to savior what can be saved yet from Yemen after their big failure, especially in the northern part of Yemen. I mean, the logic question here is, how will Hadi, or how does Hadi think that he will be running the show in the Yemeni government, or his prime minister for that matter, with the entire government is outside of Yemen?
Well, Marwa, it's frankly, in a lack of a better word, impossible for any exiled government to enforce its not only its authority, but also its jurisdictions in supposedly its own country, when without a manpower that is loyal enough to enforce the laws, rules, and procedures of the Hadi government. It is also worth to point out that the only thing that really secures the Hadi regime's presence in Yemen consists of mercenary groups terrorist groups such as the Al-Qaeda and Daesh. So that's one thing. And secondly, when this new government was announced by the prime minister of Yemen of the Hadi regime on Twitter and social media, he published an infographic containing the names and the pictures of the new appointed ministers. However, point six in this list contains ministers appointed by the advice of the Saudi embassy, which means, frankly, that the Saudis have had a hand in handpicking certain members of this new, quote-unquote, legitimate government. So this is yet another example of how the Saudi regime breaches Yemeni sovereignty, contradicting all international laws and regulations.
Well, Hun, the government consists of 24 portfolios, as the Prime Minister said, supposedly divided equally between the North and South, as stipulated in the so-called Riyadh Agreement. Yet still there is no mild attempt to even open a channel of dialogue with the rest of the country. And I'm speaking here about Ansarullah. The majority of the people who support Ansarullah here, they are excluded from the inclusive government, if you will. In light of all the achievements by the Yemeni armed forces and by the national committees of Ansarullah and the grave losses of the coalition forces, what is Mohammed bin Salman seriously waiting for, just to put an end for this needless and unnecessary war?
Well, as I think has been quite evident, at least the past few years, the Saudi regime has already lost this war. They are merely trying to take its time to save face and to keep up this illusion that the Saudi regime, with its puppet government, so-called legitimate government of Mansour Hadi, this illusion that they are working in the best interest of Yemen. That is absolutely false. One has to point out, and one has to also remember quite frankly, that the Hadi regime, when he was president during the transitional period, and his cabinet resigned in early 2015. So already there, he has no authority, no jurisdiction, no parliamentary mandate to enforce his own laws as he sees fit. I mean, it's the entire thing is one huge illusion. And if the Saudis, if they decide, okay, we have lost, admittedly, and now we are going to enter peace talks, as has been required by us, by all international parties involved in this conflict, then they would lose this, how do you say, this rock-solid firm stance towards, as they supposedly claim themselves, towards Iran, which is their main strategy. So they are not only trying to save face, but also trying to see what happens. How does this war turn out, and is it in our favor? They think, well, we'll just stick with it. It's a mess.
Well, many challenges really face this newly appointed Hadi government, like, for example, maybe improving the living conditions inside of Yemen while they are outside of Yemen. That's one. You have someone should stop the collapse and deterioration of the currency as well, which is obviously impossible without lifting the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia on the country. But another challenge is stopping the advancement of the Yemeni army and the popular committees towards what remains of the occupied Yemeni areas. I mean, Saudi Arabia and the coalition failed in achieving last challenge so far. What do you think will change when Ansarullah just fully takes the Ma'rib city, which is, I think, it's days away from doing so?
Yeah, well, currently there are many factors which make Ma'rib strategically important. One is that the city and government bearing the same name is part of the so-called Eastern Oil Triangle, which it consists of Al-Bayda, Shabwa, Ma'rib, and Al-Jouf. And the Eastern Oil Triangle is really where most of Yemen's oil reserves are located. Another key factor also is the location of Ma'rib. It's sort of a checkpoint gateway between the populated or the populous west and the barren, lesser populated but rich east, with the vast desert regions, and also paves the way for the liberation or future liberation of Hadramaut and Morgoth.
Briefly, we are hearing a lot in the Western mainstream media that when Joe Biden, president-elect of the United States of America, Joe Biden, takes the White House, he will end U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. What's your take on that, knowing that even if he actually does, this does not mean stopping the war? If you stop sending weapons to Saudi Arabia, it doesn't mean that the war will actually stop. I mean, how do you feel about this? Do you think that actually Biden would be able to maybe correct the wrongdoings of Trump, or it's just a train that will keep on moving?
Well, I have my doubts, huge skepticism of Biden's promise to end the war, considering the fact that Biden was part of the Obama-Biden administration that initially in 2015 pledged its support for the Saudi genocide of Yemeni civilians, still continuing to this day. I am sure he was briefed at the time about the consequences of this war, and I'm sure he'd been briefed also during his transitional period about the war as well. I think personally, a military pullout of Yemen, it does not solve all problems overnight. I think one thing is the United States and the Western powers need to realize the facts and separate fact from fiction, that the fact is that a government, the National Salvation Government, is in control of 85% of the Yemeni people, and has been so for the past half a decade. It has direct authority of the Yemeni people, and certainly it acts and functions as a competent government with competent leadership. If the war is truly to come to an end, I think the Western powers and the international community has to at least recognize the demands of the Yemeni majority, counting for 85% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But a shallow promises, as always, as all American presidential candidates bring about on the table during their campaigns. I'm very skeptical that
Very much, Mr. Hun Ayer, who is member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us from Copenhagen. You gave great insight into what's going on actually inside of Yemen and also inside the exiled government of Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The new data follow the ACLU's warning that America's unique obsession with incarceration has become U.S. Achilles heel when it comes to combating the spread of COVID-19, says Andrea Germanus, writer in an article titled, Analysis Finds 1 in 5 People in U.S. Prisons Infected with COVID-19. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Amid swelling calls to reduce the nation's incarceration rates in light of the ongoing pandemic, the Marshall Project and the Associated Press released a new analysis recently finding that 1 in 5 state and federal prisoners has tested positive for COVID-19 across the U.S. The rate is more than 4 times as high as the general population, the analysis noted. More than 1,700 prisoners have died from the virus, the data also showed. The figures are based on data collected weekly in prisons since March and account for cases and deaths as of recently. The Marshall Project and AP have been tracking COVID-19 data in prisons since March. So far, they found at least 275,000 prisoners have been infected with the virus, though the tally is likely an undercount. The analysis cites Homer Venters, former chief medical officer at New York's Rikers Island Jail, Homer Venters, who said, "I still encounter prisons and jails where, when people get sick, not only are they not tested, but they don't receive care." Included in the analysis are 24 state prison systems that had even higher rates than 1 in 5. In South Dakota, for example, 3 out of 5 prisoners have been infected with COVID-19. The highest rate, Arkansas, had the second highest prisoner infection rate, with 4 of every 7 having tested positive. The analysis further noted, racial disparities in the nation's criminal justice system compound the disproportionate toll of the pandemic has taken on communities of color. Black Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of whites. They're also disproportionately likely to be infected and hospitalized with COVID-19 and are more likely than other races to have a family member or close friend who has died of the virus. Human rights groups and public health experts have been urging states to roll out plans for the early release of prisoners. Calls began as early as March for compassionate releases. The month since has seen soaring infection rates and prison officials being accused of mishandling the response to the virus and denying basic necessities to stop its spread. Over 200 health experts this month said that prison population reductions would save lives and help limit the spread of the virus to communities nationwide. Physical distancing is unattainable in overcrowded and unsanitary carceral facilities, making viral outbreaks especially likely among a population with disproportionately high numbers of people who are medically vulnerable, the group wrote. The pleas for early releases, however, have largely fallen on deaf ears. In the first 3 months of the pandemic, more than 10,000 federal prisoners applied for compassionate release, the Marshall Project and AP found. Wardens denied or did not respond to almost all those requests, approving only 156, less than 2%. The new figures on COVID-19 infected prisoners align with those of the ACLU, which warned back in April that the U.S. unique obsession with incarceration has become Achilles' heel when it comes to combating the spread of COVID-19. The ACLU has accused local and state officials of failing to take adequate measures to reduce the spread of the virus in jails. And in October, the right groups sued the Trump administration to demand the immediate release of improperly withheld agency records related to federal government's failed response to spread of COVID-19 in prisons and jails. The ACLU, along with UCLA School of Law's Prison and Law Policy Program, has been maintaining a death by incarceration database. According to that tool, which covers the state, federal, and local jails, as well as ICE detention facilities, there have been 266,993 COVID-19 cases and 1,778 virus-related deaths. In the U.S. more broadly, the virus also continues its grip, even as vaccines are being given to healthcare workers recently. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has had over 17.2 million cases and over 311,000 deaths. The country's average number of daily cases across a week was 215,729 recently, CNN reported, a figure that's more than three times what the daily case average was during a summer peak in July.
Africa Today.
Iranians have a long history of ties with the East African coast. The most significant aspect of these relations is the immigration of a group of Iranians from Shiraz to the coast and islands of East Africa about 1,000 years ago.
The main substantial explanation comes from the Kilwa Chronicles. One important information that comes from this Portuguese chronicle is that the people who came, they were Iranians. That is very clear, because it says that they are from Shiraz, led by Ali bin Hassan.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenyam, and welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to the East African coasts. We shall briefly look at how this movement influenced the formation of the Swahili culture and civilization. We are also asking what efforts are being made to preserve this tangible heritage. And as you watch, let us know what you think by sending us your views and comments through our email handle, and stay tuned till the end.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa. African traditional history recognizes early connections with the Persian Gulf. The most pervasive are stories of origin from Shiraz. Historical accounts tell of the voyage of seven ships manned by a father who left Shiraz with his six sons for East Africa. He later established permanent settlements across a vast region of the eastern coast of Africa. These Iranians from Shiraz had deep and long-standing social and cultural impacts on indigenous people of East and Southern East African coasts. Many elements of Iranian culture and civilization are still visible in parts of today's Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and the Comoros.
The cultural heritage of Shirazis who settled in East Africa include the celebration of Nowruz, prevalence of Iranian architecture, and the massive influence of Persian in Kiswahili, the main language spoken by East Africans. To discuss the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to East Africa, we are joined here in the studio by Professor Amir Bahram Arab Ahmadi. He's a historian and the head of the Central and Southern Africa Studies Department at the University of Tehran. Also joining us from Tanzania is Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Professor Abdul Sharif's current research interest is on the history of Zanzibar, the Swahili coast, and the Indian Ocean. We start off with Professor Arab Ahmadi. Thanks a lot for joining us today in our program.
Thank you very much. This is a great pleasure of mine to be with you in this program for some minutes.
We're also happy to host you. Now, to start off, Professor Arab Ahmadi, now, can you tell us briefly about the immigration of Iranians to East Africa, particularly the Shirazis?
Yes, of course, before migration of Shirazis to East Africa, which resulted to permanent settlements of them in that part of Africa for quite a number of centuries, we have had some other historical contact between Iran and East Africa, which goes back to ancient era, to actually the time of Achaemenid dynasty and Sassanids.
Okay.
But talking about migration of Shirazis to East African coast,
and settlement,
which can be considered as one of the most historical events which has happened between Iran and East Africa in particular. Very briefly, I can tell you this historical migration has been taking place in 10th century during the time of Ali Buyer dynasty in Iran, in some part of Iran. Under the leadership of someone known as Prince Ali ibn Hassan Shirazi, who was then governor of Fars province. And of course, Shiraz was the capital of Fars province. They migrated to East African coast and settled in a narrow area from today's southern shores of Somali right up to northern today's Mozambique, including today's Kenya, of course, coastal area
coastal
and islands
areas.
Only.
Yeah.
Today's Kenya, Tanzania, Zanzibar Archipelago, as well as Comoros Archipelago.
Okay.
Yeah, and they made, as I mentioned, and you mentioned, too. They establish permanent settlement in quite number of islands and coastal area, something between 50 up to 80 location.
Thank you very much, Professor Arab Ahmadi, for that concise introduction. Now, the Swahili language obtained many vocabularies from Persian language. Persian poets influenced the Swahili literature through their classic works. The influence of Persian architecture is seen in Shirazi building style throughout East African coastal towns, including Lamu. Actually, Lamu is the oldest and best preserved Swahili settlement in East Africa. The influence of Persian architecture is also clearly visible in former Swahili city-states, including Mombasa, Zanzibar, and Kilwa. Founded in the 14th century, the Great Mosque of Kilwa was one of the major Persian heritage sites in Tanzania.
Two important structures dating from this era still stand. The first is the Great Mosque, which was built in the 14th century and was once the largest mosque in sub-Saharan Africa. The other is the palace at Husuni Kubwa, built between 1315 and 1330 and renowned for its spectacular pools and courtyards.
Now let's bring in Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Thank you for your time, Professor Abdul Sharif. We have heard from Dr. Arab Ahmadi here how Shirazis moved to East Africa. Now, do we still have ethnic Iranian Shirazis in East Africa?
When they came to East Africa, they intermarried with the local people. And in fact, we have one of the oldest traditions, the Kilwa tradition, a chronicle, in which it says that Hassan bin Ali, the person who came so many centuries ago, married the daughter of the local chief, and therefore his children then became legitimate from his side as well as from the mother's side. So what we should expect is not to find community of Persian-looking people now remaining exclusive somewhere. They have intermarried for 1,000 years now, and so you'll find them from brown to black. But you ask them, what is your origin? They'll say, we are Shirazi. And they will recount their history. So in that sense, they are Shirazi, not racially, but because they have been mixed for 1,000 years.
Thank you for that, Professor Abdul Sharif, a leading historian and researcher in Tanzania.
The Shirazis brought Persian traditions and customs to East Africa. They also intermarried with the local communities. Kiswahili, the language of the East African coastal regions, contains many Persian loan words. The Kiswahili language is now not just confined to East Africa after being declared an official language of the African Union.
And now we are back to the studio with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Professor, can you elaborate to us on how the Shirazis impacted on the culture of East Africans?
Yeah, this is a very deep question and, of course, should have an extensive answer.
Yeah.
To be honest, due to long-standing settlement of Shirazis in East African coast and island, approximately 500 years, and of course, since they established a very friendly relation with, indigenous people of East African coast through intermarriage, and of course, based on equality, which was very, very important for Africans. They transferred either directly or indirectly some part of Iranian culture and, of course, customs to East African indigenous people.
Okay.
For example, they have been very influential for enrichment of Kiswahili language. Right now, there have been more than 500 Persian words which have been inherited and now used in day-to-day interaction by Swahili-speaking people, either those who, Swahili language is considered as their first language or second language, no different. And, you know, this reality has been recognized by Swahili Academy of Kenya and Tanzania. Apart from Persian words, we will see strong traces of Persian or Farsi literature on Swahili literature. Some great Iranian poets such as Sa'di, Ferdowsi, Khayyam and Hafez, have been influential, of course, indirectly, to Swahili culture and Swahili literature. If we have a look at, for example, Utenzi, or for example, Fiumu Lungu Legend, or Inkishafi, we will see a type of inspiration. That those who made such this legend and books have received from Iranian literature. And of course, definitely, Shirazi had been actually link of, you know, this cultural and literary proximity.
Professor Arab Ahmadi, can you briefly also elaborate on the impact of Shirazi architecture, especially in the construction of mosques in East Africa?
Yes, thank you very much. Very good question. We will see the deep influence of Shirazis in East African coast in particular in the form of construction of mosques and, of course, stone building. For example, if we have a look to Kilwagan Mosque or Hosni Kubra Palace or Hosni Endogo or some mausoleum attribute to Shirazi kings, we will see exactly the presence and prevalence of Iranian architectural style, for example, in terms of arch, which has been used, for example, columns, bricks, for example, domes, that for the first time was used in the history of East African coast, and of course, installation of long columns on the top of some mausoleums. All are representing the existence of Iranian architectural style.
Thanks a lot. Actually, there's a lot more to discuss on this topic. Now, we're also going to get some comments from Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar on how Shirazis contributed to the culture and civilization of East Africa.
Went further, specifically to be Iranian. They seem to have probably introduced Farsi words, for example, in Kiswahili, now words in Kiswahili, which are very distinctly Persian rather than Arabic. We have the word in Kiswahili for factories is karkhana, which is obviously Farsi.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa.
Back to the studio here with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Now, you've lived in Tanzania for some years, and you witnessed the Mwaka Kogwa celebration in Zanzibar. How similar is it to the Nowruz here in Iran?
Yeah, I do remember when I was in Tanzania, I had a chance once to actually participate in Mwaka Kogwa Festival, which used to held every year in a certain township known as Makontochi. During that day, a lot of people are coming, not only from Zanzibar, but also from Kenya and Tanzania to watch it. Of course, answering to first part of your question, as I mentioned, celebration of Nowruz, which means a new day, and we actually celebrate it at the beginning of new Iranian year or new solar year. was introduced by Shirazids to indigenous people of East African coast and island, and yeah. was accepted by them. And they kept it and preserved it as a part of their own tradition, even after eradication of Shirazi kingdom.
Yeah.
They kept it and preserved it.
Yeah.
And of course, they continued